there's got to be other markets, other factors in the market. Like, obviously, there's got to be good GDP growth. I want to see a minimum of three major employers in any one market. I will not invest in a market less than 350,000 people.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we are here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. This is episode number 77. Weekly, we talk with commercial real estate investors and professionals who provide insight and knowledge to help investors grow their real estate portfolio. Whether you're a veteran investor or you've been thinking about investing, we're here to help you, and we're glad you're here. My name is Jadern Gross. Thanks for joining us today. In just a minute, we're going to speak with Reed Goossens of RSN Property Group. Reed is from Australia, from down under. He's an engineer, he's an investor, a syndicator, and he's also the host of the podcast Investing in the U.S., an Aussie's guide to U.S. real estate. We talk about the how and the why to invest in markets that are not in your backyard and more. But first, if you're listening to us on iTunes, make sure to subscribe and leave a five-star review. When you do subscribe, you can listen to the show whenever and wherever you choose. Also, are you on Facebook? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? If so, look me up. J, that's the letter J, Darren, D-A-R-R-I-N, Gross, G-R-O-S-S. And if you're on LinkedIn, be sure to check out our group and request to join the group Commercial Real Estate Pro Network group. It's a great place to network with commercial real estate professionals. So reach out and let's connect. And let me know you listen to the podcast too, as always. Like to know that. Also, I want to remind you too, if you are in the middle of a deal and you'd like to talk about it, or if you have an insurance question, go ahead and get in touch with me and I'll do all I can to help you. All right, let's get on with our show. On the call this morning, we're fortunate to have my guest. He's from Australia. He's a real estate investor. He's a multifamily real estate investor. He's also a podcaster. My guest today is Reed Goossen. Reed, welcome to the program.
G'day, Darren. Thank you so much for having me.
I couldn't be more delighted to be speaking with you today. Reed is also the proprietor, the starter, the founder of RSM Property Group, and he has his own podcast, Investing in the U.S., an Aussie's Guide to U.S. Real Estate. And we're excited to talk to you today. Reed, for the listeners, if you could do me a favor and give us a little bit about your background and how you got into real estate.
Sure thing. First and foremost, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be doing this. I know we connected a few weeks back or a few months back around Thanksgiving. So it's really, really good stuff. My background is in structural engineering. I have spent the better part of a decade being a structural engineer, working across the globe from London to Australia to New York to Los Angeles. And that I graduated in 07, went backpacking around the world for a few years, came back to Australia and picked up that little purple book called Rich Dad Poor Dad, and that really, really ignited the fire in my belly to do more with my life. I was really sort of, you know, sitting in a cubicle. You know, I'm sure the typical story, Darren, of people who sit in a cubicle get sick and tired of it. They just think there's got to be more to life than just working for a boss and being feeling like you're a small cog in a huge, huge machine. So that was in 2009. I picked up that book. In 2011, my fiance is American. And so we actually packed up our bags and moved across the world to New York City. And within 2 weeks of being in New York City, I was at my first real estate networking event. And by gosh, I thought real estate networking in Aussie was incredible, but in New York City it was on steroids. And I went out there and you know, had to teach myself about U.S. real estate because it's a lot different compared to Australia. And since then, since 2011, I've invested in quite a significant amount of real estate here in the United States. Started my own podcast to educate other international investors about the benefits of cash flow real estate, and started my own RSM Property Group. So that, in a nutshell, is me. And we can probably dive into more specifics as the show goes on.
Oh, that's great. I appreciate that. I'm curious, what was the, can you point to one of the significant differences between the Aussie real estate groups and the New York City real estate
group? Yeah, well, you know, it's New York City, right?
Right, right.
It's the Big Apple. Yeah, I think it's sort of, that's pretty self-explanatory. I guess when I say on steroids, I mean, like, you know, a group in Australia, in Brisbane, where I was from, maybe had 50 or 60 people at these at a networking event. In New York City, there was like 200. You know, it was just that much more more people. There was, you know, it's a larger city, and you know, the level of you had to bring your game up to that level of, you, everyone's in New York City. It's, you know, it's dog eat dog world, so it's just a little bit of a different vibe compared to home.
Yeah, no, I love New York City, but it is the city that doesn't sleep, and
exactly,
and there's always a lot of competition. That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the type of real estate you're in. You're in multifamily, is that correct?
That is correct. Yep.
All right. And what is it that drew you to real estate? I mean, not to real estate. You mentioned Rich Dad, Poor Dad as kind of being an impetus. But what was it that, I mean, when you talk about real estate, there's the whole gamut of possibilities. What was it that drew you to multifamily?
Yeah, that's it's a good question. So when I did first come to the US, I still was working full time as a structural engineer. And within about 6 months of being here in the United States, I'd purchased my first duplex in upstate New York. And just for all your listeners out there, the biggest difference between Australia and the United States is that you guys have like a population of 400 million people. We have a population of 25 million people. So the barriers to entry are a lot lower here in the United States compared to home, because you have a larger population, there's more housing, and so it becomes a little cheaper. And to go out and buy my first duplex for $50,000 or whatever it was, and it had a gross income of $1,200, it was just sort of, that blew my mind. And I found the power of going into that duplex and doing it up a little bit, you know, replacing the floors, replacing some cabinets, and that in turn helped me increase the cash flow. And that was really powerful, that I could control my investing by just changing, you know, rehabbing my units and increasing rent. And I thought to myself, well, if I can do it on 2 units, why can't I do it on 20 units or 50 units or 100 units? So my mind started to change to syndication and to commercial multifamily real estate. For all those listeners out there, it's more, just means more than 5 units. And it was really the power of controlling the asset and controlling the net operating income. If I can control that net operating income, I then control the value of the property, and I can control how much cash flow I get in my pocket each and every month. So that's a little bit about why I love commercial multifamily.
Well, the cash flow thing is something that I think, you know, I couldn't agree more with you. It's the I've got a number of single families, and it's always been just kind of a wait and wait and wait for the equity to build. Mm-hmm. Whether it be the decreasing balance on the mortgage or the increase in values in the neighborhood. But that's all, you know, at that point, you're waiting on the market to increase. There's not really a lot you can do. You can spruce up some stuff, but, you know, you don't want to turn your properties too much because you don't make any money in single family turns. But I guess just thinking down the advantages of your experience with multifamily, you mentioned, you know, going from 2 and recognizing the power to increase that. Did you do any kind of, you know, additional studying, or was this all just kind of like a self, reflection, self, you know, kind of taught from a standpoint of you did it yourself the first time and then recognize, hey, this adds up. I wonder if I can do more.
Yeah, I definitely was self-taught. I have an engineering background, so part of my professional job was I was involved with the ground-up construction of large apartment buildings in New York City. Plus, I'd been involved in you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure projects across the world. And when I started reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, and from 2009 to when I purchased my first property in, I think, early 2012, that was all self-education. You know, getting to as many different real estate investing seminars as possible, really just learning as much as I could, consuming as much knowledge. And I got to a point where I had analysis paralysis, and I just had to do my first deal. And I got my first deal done, and then 6 months later I did a second one, and then after that I did a third one. And then, Darren, I got to the point where I was just like, I've ran out of my own money. I want to keep growing my business, but how do I do that? And so I had to get smart. And a buddy of mine had come down from Canada, and he talked to me about, you know, syndication, or, you know, raising capital. And the penny just dropped, because, you know, take Facebook or Google or any of the big, you know, the big businesses out there. They grew by using OPM, or investors' money, to help scale their business. So in my case, my business is real estate investing, multifamily. So I just thought that was just a natural progression for me. If I want to continue down this path and make it a really, really, you know, full-time thing, that I have to start raising capital from other people and doing syndication. So it was just a natural progression to help a means to an end, so to speak.
No, absolutely. You mentioned running out of your money, and I think the whole thing that I found with syndication is the body of investors out there that are looking for a return but don't have a vehicle, mm-hmm. you know, and for an experienced investor that understands syndication and has a plan, I've heard numerous success stories, and, you know, you're another, of, you know, people that have been able to present syndication ideas or opportunities to these investors seeking return and be able to, you know, grow the assets and continue growing. So I love the story, and I just think the benefit is on all sides. You know, you've right. got the investor with the capital that's not happy with the 0.01% in the bank, maybe not as happy with what was going on in the stock market, maybe likes real estate more than the hocus pocus of the stock market. And, you know, so it's always a good fit. So when you're doing this, are there any kind of things that, confirm in the marketplace, or any ideas that when you deduce the opportunities of where to invest, is there anything that, you know, real estate jumps out? I mean, you're an engineer. That's where I guess I'm trying to come mm-hmm. from. You're an engineer. Right. Most engineers I know are very, very logical, thought process oriented. I mean, and I think if I had to do it all over, I probably would have been an engineer myself, from a standpoint of just that's kind of way the path I go down. I think that's why it always makes sense for me.
Right.
But when you were thinking about investing, was there anything in that thought process that helped you deduce as to why to do it? Or was it more mm-hmm. of a sense of, you know, this makes sense, the passive investment kind of thing that, I mean, Rich Dad, Poor Dad talks about and stuff, and having, you know, more income sources. Was there anything there that encouraged you or led you down that path, or, you know, solidified, yes, this is what I want to do, besides kind of the, you know, you said you were getting all your education in that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because you always, when you read that book, Rich Dad Poor Dad, he talks a lot about real estate in there. But in saying that, there's still so many other vehicles out there that you can invest in. Obviously, the stock market is one of those investment vehicles. And it was just really about the fact that I was working in the structural engineering game for these large developers, and it just sort of opened my eyes into, like, oh, hey, how come these guys are making so much money? But also the fact is that, and not when I first started, Darren, but when, as time has gone on, you know, the real estate is such a powerful investment vehicle. You know, you have your four forms of income from real estate. You have the tax benefits, you have cash flow, you have amortization, where the tenants pay down your loan and build up equity, and then you also have appreciation. So those four different types of ways to make money in real estate, and there's no other investment vehicle out there, or you can, you know, maybe you can make me sound like wrong, but that have those four powerful benefits that maximize everything. You know, a lot of investors just look at the return, but they don't actually understand that you got all the depreciation aspect of owning real estate is huge. The amortization, the build up of equity in any property because your tenants are paying down that mortgage. Again, another huge thing that investors just on the surface say, I just want a cash on cash return, or I want 10% or 8%. And that's why I'm happy with that. But they need to dive a little bit further into it and understand the true value of owning real estate. And again, no other investment vehicle out there matches how real estate operates.
Agreed. Hey, I want to talk to you briefly just a little bit about financing. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned when you bought a duplex, sounds like you're using more of your own funds. And did you get a note for the balance, or how'd you?
Yeah, that was a good question. So, for the listeners out there, when I first moved to the United States, I was pretty much non-existent in terms of the bank, in the bank size, because I had no credit, right? I had to build up my credit over a period of time. So the first deal that I did was really that I had some cash and I went out and bought it all cash. And then after a period of, I think, 4 or 5 months or 6 months, I developed a relationship with a local bank. I'd be depositing my rental checks in there, and they could see that the property was earning some income. And then I went to the bank after a period of seasoning and said to them, hey, do you reckon I could get, refinance some money out of this deal and buy a second one? And they said, sure thing. I got a $30,000 mortgage or a note on that. And I went and bought deal number two. And then deal number three. So yes, I did, eventually get some financing for it. However, at the beginning, when I first, ventured here, because I was a quote unquote foreign national and no credit score, it was a little bit tough. So I had to think a little bit outside the box. And that's where it helped me develop my podcast, Investing in the US, is because there's other investors out there who want to, maximize on the cash flow and opportunities here in the United States. However, they're not educated on, the financing side of it, or how you get all the legal entity structuring set up. What about the taxes, all that sort of stuff. And I went through those hoops when I first started here, because that was part and parcel of what I had to do, right? I had to learn quickly. Is throw me in the deep end and make me swim, right? So,
right. Well, and I'm curious too on the financing. With your experience with the local or the bank that you were working with, and your first property was a duplex. What was your mm-hmm. second property? What was your
another duplex? Another duplex. Yeah.
Okay. And at what point did you get into north of 5 units?
Yeah, that was back in 2015, and I got to a point where, as in my buddy from Canada came down. I can remember the conversation. We went out for a drink around Christmas time, and he said, I said to him, "Oh, guess what I'm buying? I've got three properties in upstate New York, six little units." And I thought, I was killing it. And he turned to me and said, "That's awesome, Reid. I actually just closed on 70 units in Canada." And I said, "Yeah, what?" Like, it just blew my mind. I was like, "How? Whoa, explain how you did that." And then he walked through the explanation of getting a mentor and understanding syndication. And so that was in 2013. In 2014, I went and got, middle of 2014, I went and got a mentor. And then from there, I, in 2015, helped close on a 250-unit property in Houston, Texas. And then since then, we've done two other deals. One's 296 units and the other's 320 units, and looking to do more in 2017. And for your listeners out there, doing one or two deals a year is of these larger size deals is pretty good. I'd love to do more, but these deals do take a long time to close on and raise the capital and do all the due diligence. So, you don't do as many, the volume that isn't there, but you get the volume in terms of how many units you're buying at any one time.
Well, first of all, That's huge. Since 2015 to now, to have, 296, 320, what do you get? Almost 900 units. Is that?
Yeah. I'm a what's called a co-GP. So I don't own all the 900 units, but I own a portion thereof because I raised a bunch of capital for those deals.
Sure. Well, in any case, the numbers are impressive. To be a part of that's awesome. What's your experience in the lending aspects with the smaller, obviously with the smaller units for three properties? I'm guessing the bank was pretty happy. They got to know you and they knew the assets and saw your deposits and all that, make it sense. But from a standpoint of a single family or anything under four units, kind of borrowing as opposed to going into the commercial. Do you have any kind of sense of the degree of difficulty?
Yeah. Are you talking under four units or and versus over four units?
Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, under four units, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware, classed as quote unquote residential. And that's where the bank will obviously look at you, the borrower, and how you can fund the deal, how you can service the loan. So the bank obviously looks at you because when it's under four units, the risk of someone leaving, say you've got a single family house, right? The bank will always look at you, the borrower, rather than the asset itself, because if the property goes becomes vacant, that means your single family property is 100% vacant, and you know who's going to service the debt then? And then that's why they underwrite you as the borrower. In commercial, when it's over 5 units. The banks tend to look at more the deal itself. So, and the risk of, say, you have a 10 or 20 unit property that all the tenants just get up and leave and the property is vacant, and who can service the debt, it's a lot lower risk than that 20 tenants will get up and move compared to a single family property where it's just one tenant, right? So the value of doing commercial is that it actually is it's a little bit easier to obtain financing in the commercial sense because they underwrite the deal rather than underwrite you as the borrower. Some of the nuances of large deals is that when you start getting into really, really large deals, banks do want to see partners involved in the deal who have a net worth of the balance of the loan. And we can dive into a whole topic of how that works in financing. But yeah, on all the deals that I've been involved in, we've had what's called a key principal. And that person has really been, you know, bring the bank balance to those big deals because everyone's saying, well, how do you go from, you know, six property or six units to, you know, 250? It's like, well, there's a process there. And it's about educating yourself on that process. And one of those things is with the financing aspect is that you need a KP involved in your deal so you can, you know, show that you've got experience, right? So yeah.
Got it. Well, I'd love to get into that more, but right, I think what I want to run with you on today was more of kind of you were in New York, you were buying properties in New York, you're now down in Southern California, but you've got properties in Houston.
Yep.
And help the listeners understand why you would invest out of the area as opposed to where you were or where you were, you know, up in New York.
Yeah, that's so I now live in Los Angeles, but at the time, yeah, investing obviously in New York is very expensive. And what's called the cap rate, the capitalization rate in sort of what I like to call tier one cities, which is your New York's, your Los Angeles, your Portland, Oregon's, I would class as a tier one city, one where there's really desirable location to live. And they have lower cap rates because the risk of it's lower risk. So if someone says, you or the cap rate in this market is 4% compared to another market which might be 8%, it's lower, it's a measure of risk, so that cap rate in that particular market of 4% is a lot lower. However, cap rate is the ratio of income to purchase price or value. So on markets where the cap rates are lower, it's very hard to make cash flow. And in my world, cash flow is king. So I definitely look for tier two markets like your Houston's, like your Dallas Fort Worth, like your Kansas City, Missouri's, where I can go in and the cap rates in those markets are 200 basis points above national interest rates. So what, we're at 4.5% now. So I'm looking at markets around the 6.5 to 7% cap rates, because that means I can make solid cash flow, and I can, you know, I can, you know, make sure I can pay my investors, and we all get to benefit in the cash flow and in the appreciation of the property.
So when your tier one markets you mentioned, do you typically finance more of a 1-to-1 based on interest rates to cap rate?
Yeah, I do. And again, it's a different strategy. I don't do a lot of investing in tier one cities, so I don't have a lot of experience in terms of what's like tier one cities in my mind. We can dive real granular. Is that they have existing assets are trading above replacement costs. So, you know, right now in Los Angeles, there's a lot of cranes in the air because to build out new product because the demand is still there. You have to, the existing assets, it's just cheaper to build than it is to go and buy an existing asset. However, in a place like Houston, Texas, or Dallas, Fort Worth, yes, there is still construction going on, but those existing multifamilies are actually trading less than when I'm talking about existing multifamilies, I'm talking about like Class C assets built in the 1980s. They're trading less than the cost of replacement. So that, because of that, you know, where we are in the market cycle right now, that is more attractive to me and helps me produce cash flow for all my investors.
Got it. So is it cash flow is pretty much the driver then that drives you looking elsewhere?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, cash flow is king in my world. I love appreciation, and that's great. And I can force the appreciation through increasing NOI, net operating income. But first and foremost, I invest for cash flow, and then secondly, I invest for appreciation.
Gotcha. When you're looking in the different markets, is there any kind of like cycles or any kind of thing that you see? I mean, obviously, if you're taking a snapshot of the marketplace today and you pick all these different markets, you can do a comparison as of a date. But is there, you mentioned all the cranes in L.A. I know there's a lot of multifamily construction going on up here in Portland. Is there any kind of a cycle that you tend to recognize or anticipate?
Yeah. I not anticipate, like, no one's got a crystal ball, but if it depends on who you subscribe to. I subscribe to a few different publications, and I definitely keep my eye on where we are in the market cycle, given the asset of multifamily. It is pretty hot right now. Dallas, Fort Worth, and Texas areas are really, really hot, and every man and his dog are wanting to get involved in multifamily. But that doesn't necessarily mean there's still not deals out there you can go find. It just means it's harder to find those deals. My motto is that you always make money when you buy and not when you sell. And given where we are in the marketplace right now, interest rates are starting to, they're expected to go up. But so that means when interest rates go up, so do cap rates. So cap rates will start trending upwards, which means that it will transition from, in the markets that I invest in, more of a seller's market into more of a buyer's market. And that's what I'm anticipating, hopefully, in 2017 and beyond, that will transition away from the last 2 or 3 years of really being a seller's market into, as I said, more of a buyer's market. And again, there's always deals out there to be had, regardless of where we are in the market cycle. It's just about your ability to find those good deals, or I like to call them Kraken deals. So, yeah.
Oh, amen to that. What you mentioned that interest rates and cap rates track, is that is that based on that spread kind of thing you were talking about?
Just in general, it's based, the rule of thumb is that you can't expect interest rates to go up without some sort of effect on cap rates in that market. You couldn't imagine that if interest rates are going up and then cap rates remain the same, that doesn't really make sense. Because sure. then you're transitioning into a tier one market. Not necessarily that doesn't happen. Of course it does. Austin, Texas is a prime example of, 20 years ago, it was what I call a linear market, where cap rates were, there's a good difference between cap rates and interest rates. But now, Austin, Texas is a really, really hot market, and some would say nearly a tier one market. So again, they track one on each other. So if interest rates go up, so do cap rates. If interest rates go down, so do cap rates. So yeah,
gotcha. In the Midwest, in there, the Texas, I mean, Austin sounds like it's kind of an outlier. I don't say an outlier, but it's clearly a hot market that are
right.
I would say kind of more reflective of like some of the coastal markets. Do you find, or have you looked in other, you mentioned Kansas City, Houston, do you find most of the Midwest in a similar market? Yep. As far as the cap rates?
Yes, I do. And again, it goes from a macro point of view. I'm sure if you jump on any Google website and said, cap rates in the Midwest, I'm sure you're going to find roughly in and around, or for Class C and Class B assets, around the 6 to 8% cap rates. So that's really where I look for. Again, it hits those from a macro point of view. It's 200 basis points roughly above while we are on interest rates, so that makes sense to me, and I'll move forward. There's got to be other markets, other factors in the market. Like, obviously, there's got to be good GDP growth. I want to see a minimum of 3 major employers in any one market. I would not invest in a market less than 350,000 people. It's just too risky. A lot of people have invested in smaller markets, oil-based markets, and have been burnt. So I want to try and be insular to market fluctuations in commodity prices and stuff like that. So that's why I look for those 3 major employers.
I want to drill down on this just a little bit, because I think this is something that I think anybody that's really looking outside of where they live, based on the affordability of their opportunity to invest, if they are living in a coastal town and and you know, it's out of reach for them there. They want to look elsewhere. So when you mentioned a couple things, so three major employers is when you say a major employer,
how do I determine it's major? Yeah. So like, for example, let's take, I don't know, Dallas-Fort Worth, right? They've had, if you look at the major employers, their healthcare is a major employer, financing sector is a major employer now. The banking sector is a major employer. Education's a major employer. You know, Dallas has really diversified compared to what historically it was, being an oil town way back in the 30, 40 years ago. Houston, however, hasn't transitioned as much as what Dallas has. So, but I still want to see those major employers. So it's sort of just, now, what's a major employer? Well, I don't know, someone who owns employs over 1,000 people, you could class as a major employer, or someone who employs over 2,000 people. But you just really want to see that they've got longevity in their sectors. So education, medical is really good, and banking are the big three that I look for. Military, not so much, and mining, definitely. I don't want it to be a town that is reliant heavily upon mining or something like that.
So you're not in North Dakota, is that what you're saying?
in the gas lands.
Yeah. You mentioned 350,000 people. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good bar for entry, because I'm thinking a lot of your college towns are out of that. Then you're not looking at any kind of college town, or at least not unless they're more of a metro. Right. Kind of a town, but I'm thinking of, you know, I went to Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas, and I don't think that, I think maybe I'd be shocked if there's 100 there, but that's is there any kind of like an airport you associate with those kind of towns? I mean, 350, I'm trying to think of
Like 350 is a number. I will if it's a really, really hot deal and in the town's only 250, like I'm not splitting hairs here. It's just sort of a starting point.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm just trying to think of a town that I'm trying to think in my mind of one that fits that with as far as the numbers are, because I think Portland's, I don't know, somewhere between a million and a million and a half as far as the metro, when you take in all the surrounding areas. I think, what is Boise? Is that?
Yep, that could be another Boise, Idaho. Yep, okay. That's a good example. I don't know much about Boise, but it sounds like it would be – it's just – these are all just litmus tests for your listeners out there, just to keep that in mind. You do want a bit of a population base there. You want to see that population is growing. You don't want to see it that it's declining, because that's a big red flag. And again, those three major employers, you want people who want to move there. So you want to just see a steady increase in population over a period of 10 to 20 years. That's a good sign that it's a solid market. And then, have that go hand in hand with the population and the employers, and it's got moderate cap rates and affordability's high, then that's great. They're all tick, tick, tick. Then let's take the next step and start contacting some brokers.
I like you just spelling out some, basic parameters, because I mean I've learned over time, whether it was a car or a boat or even a rental property, if you don't have the built-in demand, you may be stuck. Or you may be selling at a discount if there's nobody out there to buy your boat. Anyway, we can go on about that. But in these markets, and do you we've talked about the size of the population, the employment base. Do you look at any kind of a and then the cap rate, obviously, but what about like affordability? Is there any kind of bar you draw to as far as wages and what the housing cost and that kind of stuff, and what's going on?
Yeah, so I know there's so many different – I know there's a lot of metrics out there that different people talk about, affordability indexes and stuff like that, and I do look at the affordability index, but my target market and demographic are a blue-collar cops, teachers, people who probably won't own a house or have been burnt back in 2008 and just won't ever own a house again. So the median household income for one of my units may be around the $50,000 or less a year. Factory workers are a big one. And so when I look at that, I definitely want to keep in mind rents to household incomes or the average household incomes in those neighborhoods. Another good thing or indication to track is you do really don't, and there's no rule of thumb, but you just want to be understanding what sort of percentage of, say, the household income is spent on rent in that neighborhood. Now, if it starts creeping above, 45 to 50%, then maybe I believe that maybe, rents are too much in that market. So typically in Class C neighborhoods, you're looking at about 25 to 30% of their income is spent on rents. So you're looking at around the $600 a month to $700 a month for someone who earns, about $50,000 a year. So they're the sort of metrics that I look at, and I try and keep my finger on the pulse as much as possible. But again, we are trending towards a more of a multifamily state. A lot more millennials are not settling down and buying houses, which is causing a more pressure in the multifamily game, and why I like multifamily, because there is always a demand for people to have a roof over their heads. And historical data will show that house ownership is declining in the age gap between 25 to 30 or 25 to 40, I should say. And that is a very, very strong indication that multifamily is a solid asset to be investing in compared to, say, office, or compared to retail, or compared to commercial. So, yeah.
No, I like it. Start looking outside and you don't know all the streets and you don't know all the particulars of a certain area, you got to have some sort of an idea, kind of a plan going in, and some sort of a basis for why you're doing what you're doing if you want to be successful. Otherwise, you're probably just looking to be the next sucker to take somebody else's troubles and good luck with that. So that's all very good. Reed, I'm trying to think. Is there any more kind of a secret kind of a thought process that you look to, or that you'd share with the listeners when you're out hunting for markets?
The other big thing that I, like, people always ask when you're investing into state or you're doing what's called a desktop study of a market. It's not sexy, but what I always recommend, people that I talk to, go out and analyze at least 50 deals in that market, and whether it's a deal or not, like, just get on LoopNet, get on Craigslist, get on some brokers' websites. It's about doing the analysis to understand, okay, what is price per door? That's a very common metric people will use. So understand what the price per door is. Understand what the average expense ratio is going to be. Until you do, 50 deals or more in a market, you won't be able to get a good sense as if you're paying too much or too little for a property. So as a good saying my dad always used to said was, a fool and their money are easily parted. You can go and analyze it till the cows come home, and it doesn't cost you anything besides your time. But what you're doing is, through analyzing so many deals, you're becoming more educated on your market. You're going to understand where certain suburbs are better to invest in and where are not. And that there would just, you can do that all from your desk at from halfway across the America. You don't need to be in that particular market to go and walk the streets and understand that. Just through doing the metrics, you're going to be able to establish a better idea of where you're going to invest in that particular chosen market once you have chosen it.
No, that makes complete sense. The kind of doing your homework and really getting that kind of a base of understanding and I think the real treasure in that is that when you do come across a real deal after you've done all that homework, you're going to recognize it. It's going to jump off the page and oh my God.
Yeah. But again, you don't, people who just think they can get, like, you've got to do those 25 deals. Otherwise, you don't know if you've been presenting a good deal, right? Like, everyone's like, how do I know if I've been presenting a good deal? It's like, well, unfortunately, you've got to go through analyze those 25 to 50 deals, and they're not going to be deals, but you'll understand why they're not deals, because it's just, it's too expensive, or the price per door is too expensive, or the utilities, the expense ratio is too high, and this doesn't make sense for cash flow. So, as I said, be educated, make sure you do your homework. If you can get a mentor or go to a local real estate investing club to learn more, I 100% recommend do that, because that's where everyone should start. You should start with education first, and don't rely on Uncle Bill told me one time about this about this market. So go out there, be methodical, set up some systems, set up some criteria, and yeah, you're going to be, you put yourself in a better place to be more successful.
I like it. Reed, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this today. Before we shut this down, tell the listeners how to best get in touch with you.
Yeah, sure thing. You can head over to my website, which is rsnpropertygroup.com. R for Roger, S for Sam, N for Nancy. You can click on my podcast tab, and I educate more of the international investors. But again, it's all education at the end of the day. It's for anyone who wants to tune in and learn about American real estate investing. If you are ever in the LA area and you want to, you know, meet up and just have a yarn or have a coffee, then you can hit me up at reed@rsnpropertygroup.com. And I do have a free ebook if anyone is interested in getting their hands on a free ebook. You can just email me and say free ebook at reed@rsnpropertygroup.com and just put your name in the subject line, Darren, and yeah, I'll flick them on to all your listeners.
That's great. And I'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes. So if you're driving or not able to take that down right now, don't worry, it's there. But hey, Reed, I appreciate you taking the time to do this, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Cheers, mate. Thanks so much.
Well, Reed is one energetic guy. I hope you appreciate his insight on how to recognize and select different markets to invest in, and how to do the homework that you must do to get educated, especially if you're investing in markets that are further away than the town you live in. Be sure to check out Reed's website. That's www.rsnpropertygroup.com. He's also, be sure to check out his podcast, Investing in the U.S., An Aussie's Guide to Real Estate. And also, he offered up his free ebook. You can send him an email at Reed, R-E-E-D, at rsnpropertygroup.com. That's all we've got this week. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Networks, CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.